walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet.
Good evening and welcome to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. I'm Athenia, chair of the Kodiak Public Library Association and host of your show today. Today, we have Leslie Leland Fields on our show. Many of you are probably familiar with this name. She is somebody we are proud to call neighbor and friend here on Kodiak Island. James Raines is talking to her about her latest book called Crossing the Waters, Following Jesus Through the Storms, the Fish, the Doubt, and the Seas. Later on in our show, Katie Baxter from the Kodiak Public Library drops by to have a little lively live chat with me about what to read over the winter season and some storytelling events that are happening at the Kodiak Public Library. And Leanne drops by to fill out the hour with a little book review for everybody out there. So all in all, it's a great December show we have for you. I really encourage you to stick around for the full hour and check out everything that we have to offer here at Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the Kodiak Public Library Association.
Another lovely victim of the mirror, evil way.
I'm very excited to introduce the author that's speaking with James today on Dog-Eared Reads. That is Leslie Leland Fields. Leslie Leland Fields is one of the best-known authors on Kodiak Island. She's the writer of, I believe, 10 books, as well as various other published essays and articles. She also speaks at public events and teaches seminars and workshops on writing, as well as hosting the annual Harvester Island Wilderness Workshops spiritual retreat. In the summers, along with her family and some crew members, they commercially fish salmon and process and sell their product as Fields Wild Salmon. On a personal note, when I got married to my husband in 2006 and was getting ready to come and fish with him on our SetNet site for the first year ever, as an introduction to what commercial fishing could be, I read The Entangling Net by Leslie Leland Fields and found it to be a vastly inspiring book that helped see me through some of the rougher days of commercial fishing. So I've been a fan of Leslie Leland Fields' writing for quite a number of years, and I highly recommend that anybody out there that doesn't know about Leslie Leland Fields' work should really check it out. She has a wonderful body of writing that I believe does a great job of capturing what it's like to commercially fish in Alaska as well as to live here in Alaska. Just recently here, on October 1st of 2016, Leslie's latest book came out. It's called Crossing the Waters, Following Jesus Through the Storms, the Fish, the Doubt, and the Seas. She is also the author of some other books, including Forgiving Our Fathers and Mothers, Finding Freedom from Hurt and Hate, which was published in 2014, The Spirit of Food, 34 Writers on Feasting and Fasting Toward God, published in 2010, Parenting is Your Highest Calling, and 8 Other Myths That Trap Us in Worry and Guilt, published in 2008. Surprise Child, Finding Hope in Unexpected Pregnancy, published in 2006. And Surviving the Isle of Grace, Life on the Wild Edge of America, published in 2002. Hooked, True Stories of Obsession, Death, and Love from Alaska's Commercial Fishing Men and Women, published in 2001. Out on the Deep Blue, Women, Men, and the Oceans They Fish, which was published in 2001. And like I said before, Leslie also wrote The Entangling Net, Alaska's Commercial Fishing Women Tell Their Lives, published in 1996. Leslie Leland Fields is an active member of the Kodiak community, both professionally and personally, and we're very proud to have her on our show today. So without further ado, I would like to introduce James Raines and Leslie Leland Fields to our show today, Beyond the Cover on Dog-Eared Reads.
All right, today on our show we have Leslie Leland Fields with us. Leslie, welcome.
Hi, James. Great to be here with you.
So, Leslie, could you tell our viewers a little bit about your upbringing and where you're from and who had a major impact on your life?
Oh, my goodness. You just asked three really big questions all in one. All right. So, I grew up in New Hampshire. I grew up out in the woods. very rural settings. And my family moved around a lot because my father wasn't able to work. And my mother wasn't able to work because she had six children. Oh. And she really didn't have an opportunity to work outside the home. So we were quite desperately poor. And then my mother came up with a brilliant idea. The house that we were living in was a 200-year-old colonial, and it was a mess. And she thought, well, maybe I can teach myself how to do woodworking and how to fix this thing up. And so I think I was probably 5 or 6 years old when we started. And she literally did that. She taught herself how to do everything from building fireplaces to wiring and plumbing to changing out the window. I mean, we did everything. So that became our family business, our family okay. job. We would live in a house and move into an old derelict house. All of us kids, we were the labor force. There were okay. six of us kids and my mother. My father was often not there. Occasionally he was there. And we did all the work ourselves. And,
oh, wow.
and when it was done and when we could sell it, we would move to the next one. A lot of people think you moved to Kodiak and you're from New Hampshire. And I think they imagine sort of East Coast urban. I don't know. They think city and they think, what a change for you that must have been. And you know what really wasn't? Because okay. I grew up chopping wood and hauling water. Our well would go dry in the summer and carrying buckets of water across a long field. And we hayed our fields by hand okay. with a oh, scythe wow. and we milked goats. And so that was my upbringing. And I learned to work really, really hard. That's what we did. We had to work really hard just to have food on the table. And that was always a question. There was hunger and there were not very many clothes. And one pair of shoes a year and, you know, that sort of thing. So we were poor. And I think nothing fits you better for life in some ways than poverty. And so that was your first question, first out of three. What was your okay. next question?
What was something that had a major impact on your life that actually led to your writing?
You know, so I was the weird one in my family who loved to read okay. and who loved to write. And I can literally remember I started school first grade when I was 5 years old. And I remember getting our first assignment to write a poem. And I loved poems. When I turned five, I'd gotten a Mother Goose book. And I had basically memorized all of those Mother Goose rhymes. And they're so great because they have rhythm and rhyme and they tell a story and there's imagery and metaphor and all of that. So I really internalized all of that. So here I was in first grade now with those great big fat pencils, you know, and the sort of brownish paper. And we had to write our first poem. And I was so excited. And I can remember just a few, you know, lines of it. Night is falling. The owl is calling. Some animals are sleeping. Some animals are creeping. And then it goes on in a similar way. And that sort of lit the fire for me. So writing became a really big thing in my life. I used it, you know, the way that we use writing. You're a writer, you understand. We use writing as a way to understand the world. And there's a lot of stuff that was going on in my home and in the towns that we lived in. There were some really, really hard places that we lived. A lot of bullying and taunting and threats. You know, I was going to get beat up every day after school by this gang of kids. You know, that stuff, it just went on and on. And writing was really a huge outlet for me. And poetry was what I wrote mostly then.
All right, excellent. So how many places do you think you lived and rehabbed these homes during your youth?
You know, we probably did 15 houses.
Okay.
But we didn't live in all 15. We'd be living in a house and then we'd go on weekends to another house.
Okay.
So I would say about 15 houses.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was a lot. And the one, you know, the one that sticks out of my memory the most is in high school, the house that I lived in. This is in New Hampshire, and it didn't have heat except for a wood stove. And those 200-year-old houses have no insulation.
Okay.
So the only place it was warm in the house was right around the stove. And so sometimes we'd even sit on the stove to try mm-hmm. to be warm. But the rest of the house, you know, if it's 25 outside, it's 25, mm-hmm. you know, degrees in our room. So.
Okay.
Yeah, those were kind of hard times.
Did your dad move with you to those 15 places?
He did, but my father was mentally ill, and so he really wasn't in the picture very much, except when he was, and it was in a really bad way. Yeah. So,
what are your dreams and passions?
Oh, You know, I feel like I'm living my dreams and passions right now.
Okay.
I'm so thankful that I get to write and I get to do what I'm doing. I write books, I write articles, I write for magazines, I have a blog, I travel and speak all around the country. Sometimes I get to preach in churches and I lead writers' workshops. I have a workshop out at my fish camp island. I do lots of radio shows. I love it all. And I didn't dream a lot when I was a kid. In my family, we didn't talk about the future. We didn't. But I did have this one idea that I wanted to be a writer. And it was a far away hope because I didn't know any writers. And the only writers I knew, of course, they had books on a shelf. I could never do that, you know. But I love to write so much. And in my heart of hearts, that's what I wanted to do. And sometimes I pinch myself to think, wow, I'm doing what I always wanted to do.
Excellent. So can you discuss a little bit about your work in writing education?
Yes, I have been teaching writing for a lot of years in a lot of different venues. I started out in graduate school when I was doing a couple of master's degrees. I started teaching freshman comp then, and it was one of those moments. You know, I was doing it because I'd gotten a fellowship. You know, I got paid, and all my grad classes were free. Yeah, so of course I was going to do this. But it was just this incredible experience of sort of walking into that classroom. And the light bulb for me truly went on. And I discovered I loved teaching. And teaching became a passion of mine. So I was 26 when I first started teaching at the college level. And it really was an epiphany. I had no idea that I would love teaching. And so I've taught in one form or another since then.
Okay.
I taught as an adjunct at University of Alaska in Anchorage for a couple of years. And then I came here and taught as an adjunct at the college here for probably 10 years.
All right.
And then I was the English professor here at the college for 5 years. And then I taught in a graduate program, a Master of Fine Arts program through Seattle Pacific University.
Okay.
And I ended up resigning. I taught in that program for 6 years. And it was just fantastic. I love having grad students as my students. But it was the teaching part was just gobbling up my own writing time. And it just takes so much energy and so much emotion to work with my students. I just came to the place I thought, you know, I think it's time for me to just focus on my own work. And that's what I've been doing. And I think I resigned about 5 years ago. I still get to teach. I still travel and speak and lead writing workshops. And I love that. But it's not every day. And it's, you know, it's not that same kind of drain. And now my teaching feeds me and it's exciting. And I love mentoring other writers and taking them from wherever they are, you know, up to the next step and the next step. And I have some of my students who have gone on to publish books and become successful writers themselves. And that is like, as you say, that's like being a mother. I already know what it's like to be a mother. That's like being a grandmother or something. It's a really great feeling.
Excellent. So can you list some of your books that you have written?
Yeah, I'll go backwards since the most recent ones I can remember better. I have a brand new one that's out that just released last month called Crossing the Waters, Following Jesus Through the Storms, the Fish, the Doubt, and the Seas. And then the book before that was Forgiving Our Fathers and Mothers. Okay, let's see. The book before that, I think, was The Spirit of Food, a book on the spirituality of all aspects of food. And let's see, before that, Parenting is Your Highest Calling and 8 Other Myths. You need that book, James, since you're going to be a father here soon.
I know. It's on the list.
Surprise Child was before that, Finding Hope in Unexpected Pregnancy. And, I forgot a book in there, Hooked, 2 Stories of Love, Death, and Obsession from Alaska's Fishing Men and Women, I think. I have a thing with long subtitles. It's just like every one of my books has a really long subtitle. There's a few more in there, Out in the Deep Blue and The Entangling Net. And my first book was a book of poetry. I really did begin in poetry, and that's called The Water Under Fish. So that's 10 or 11 books. There they are.
All right. Excellent.
All my children.
All right. There's a lot of them. I know when I go into Cost Savers, for example, there's definitely a place there where you can purchase your books.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about your newest book, Crossing the Waters. How did you derive the title for your book?
Well, I'm just such a literary geek, right? And I love metaphor. And so it, you know, it's like a triple layer metaphor. And that's exactly what the book is doing too. It's three narratives that are braided together into a single narrative. So crossing the waters means, in one sense, I cross the waters from the United States over to Israel.
Okay.
I crossed the waters there because I spent time in the Sea of Galilee, and I hiked the trail around the Sea of Galilee, a new trail, by myself, which was really, really fun. And then it also refers to our fish camp on the other side of Kodiak Island, where I've been fishing with my family for almost 40 years now. And so it's crossing those waters as well. So it's really sort of three bodies of water. It's all about sort of movement from where we start to ending up somewhere very, very different. And water, they can be calm and quiet and beautiful and halcyon, or, you know, it can be a raging torment. So everything that water does, that's what happens in this book.
Okay. So would you say this is then a part of a real story, which is your story?
It's creative nonfiction.
Okay.
So yes, it's all first person. It's all my experience.
All right. Excellent. What was the hardest part of writing this book?
The hardest part was writing the book, James.
Okay.
It always is. I know. No, the hardest part about this book, some of my books, they're very personal, like Forgiving Our Fathers and Mothers. And oh, I forgot my memoir, Surviving the Island of Grace. I don't know why I forgot that. I actually spent 8 years writing that book. I should never forget that book. But the hardest part about this book, I mean, all my books have been a challenge, really a challenge. But this book was even more of a challenge. And I did it to myself. I had this idea, three narratives. So it takes the reader through a particular summer out at our fish camp. And then it takes the reader over to Israel.
Okay.
On that hike around the Sea of Galilee. And then the third journey is it takes the reader through the gospel accounts. That's what the following Jesus part is. And so I'm identifying with the disciples, and half of them were fishermen, were commercial fishermen.
Okay.
So I'm walking in their shoes, you know, as the skeptic, you know, someone who like doesn't understand what is going on here, all these things that are happening. So I'm braiding all of these stories together into a single story.
Okay.
And that's what was difficult. And it started off, it felt very organic and it felt just natural and it wasn't difficult. But by the time I got halfway through, I just thought, how am I going to do this? How am I going to finish it? It was really hard. But I did finish, and I'm quite satisfied with the result. And one of the best things that I hear from readers is that when they pick it up, they can't put it down. That's always what I want. I want the story to be a very compelling forward narrative that has a strong narrative drive. And that can be difficult in memoir. With this particular structure, it felt difficult, but it actually worked. And I'm glad that, you know, as a writer, you're always looking to grow. You're always looking to stretch abilities. And this book really, really did stretch my abilities.
Well, it's definitely a testament to your writing to be able to weave stories, multiple stories into one. In my experience, every newer author, a younger author, they have that idea that I'm going to write this great epic that's going to be all these stories interwoven.
Mm. Yeah.
And then they start down the trail and they realize, I just don't have the skill to do this. It sounds like, and I've heard lots of people say this, and they say that you weave those tales masterfully.
Thank you. That's
exciting. You kind of mentioned some of the other questions I had, but how can the public purchase your book here on the island and maybe even off island?
Yeah, Cost Savers carries most of my books, I think. I think Monk's Rock has some. That's all I know of locally. And of course, online, it's, you know, on all your favorite online bookstores as well.
Is this a book you could purchase at like the Christian Book Distributors, the CBD website as well?
I'm sure. Okay. I'm sure. Yeah.
Do you have any upcoming dates for like future book events or book signings?
Not locally. I don't. But I'm always available. If I'm in town, I'm available. And I love to do readings and signings and all that kind of thing. I have a lot going on, you know, outside in other places and in Florida and California and various other places. But yeah, not here.
All right.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. On this month's episode of Beyond the Cover, we're interviewing Kodiak's own Leslie Leland Fields. Leslie Leland Fields is an accomplished writer, speaker, and teacher who lives and works here in Kodiak, as well as spending her summers on an island off Kodiak with her family, commercially fishing and producing Fields Wild Salmon, which you may have seen in the local grocery store. grocery stores. Today, James Raines is talking to Leslie Leland Fields about her latest book called Crossing the Waters, Following Jesus Through the Storms, the Fish, the Doubt, and the Seas.
What do you think you learned from writing this book?
Well, one thing I want to say is, if you read the book, you'll find out. You know what? The thing is, that's such a great question, because a lot of people think that a book that, you know, writers like know all this stuff, and then because they know it, they write it down. And that's the opposite of what it really is. Writers don't know anything. And that's the reason we write. We write to find out. We write to learn and discover. And that's what's so addictive to me about the process. And I was really intrigued just by this whole idea that six of those 12 guys who first, you know, met this weird rabbi named Jesus, they had no idea who he was and what he was about. And they had a lot of wrong ideas, but they thought, okay, we're just going to kind of follow along and, you know, see what happens. And that's kind of how it is as a writer too. I really get sort of seized with an idea or a compulsion, and I have to go in that direction. A lot of times I know very little as I begin, and it's through the process of writing. And I'm not a fast writer. I mean, this book, I probably have 3 years into this book, because it's not just language work, it's soul work, it's spirit work, mind and heart work. You know, it's the whole body, the whole self that really comes under the tutelage of language and under the tutelage of these experiences.
Or you get this great thought about what you want to do with the scene in your book, even though you're in the middle of something completely different.
Oh my goodness, all the time. There's always, no matter what you're doing, there's always another. There's a ticker tape running through your head on a completely different plane, no matter what you're doing.
And I thought I had read someplace on your website that you actually help develop the Master of Fine Arts program for
Seattle Pacific University. Yeah, I was a founding faculty member, so I was in on the ground floor. It's a really excellent program. I was honored to teach in it for 6 years.
Now, would you recommend the Master of Fine Arts program for anybody who does want to improve their skill set in writing?
That's a longer conversation. Okay. And I have that conversation a lot with my students and the people who come to my workshops. I think the MFA, Master of Fine Arts, can be a very valuable degree. But people who do it have to understand it's not going to get you a job. It's not going to help you publish a book. It's kind of irrelevant to both of those things. Okay. But are you going to grow as a writer and be stretched and pushed and learn? Absolutely.
All right. Excellent. So I'm looking at your book, Crossing the Waters, and you had talked about this earlier, the idea of water, and I'm looking at it and there are waves and they're exploding
yes,
all over the cover.
Yes.
Who designed your cover?
My publisher is Nav Press for this book, and they have a graphic arts department. And this is one of the fun things coming to that cover design. In all of my contracts, I always make sure that it's written in the contract that I work with the department and approve the cover. So some of my book covers, there's just been such wrangling and back and forth and just a little bit of hard feelings here and there, because I'm pretty insistent about getting that cover right. They had a couple of other covers, but when I saw that, bingo, I knew that was it. There's so many books that have just sort of maybe a placid or static kind of image. And this is a book that needed action. I wanted it to feel very sort of muscular because the book itself is. It's very action oriented.
Do you have a writer who is a mentor to you?
There's a writer whom I esteem above all others, and who has been very formative in my own work. And he knows that I exist. He turned 90 not too long ago, and I was able to send him a video birthday greeting. I was interviewed for that birthday greeting. His name is Frederick Buechner. He has written upwards of 30 books. He is just an amazing writer and was nominated for all kinds of awards. He writes both fiction and creative nonfiction. Memoir really is his nonfiction genre. But everything he writes is just breathtakingly beautiful. And he has a way of writing about the most mundane of moments and always finding something significant and real and meaningful in that moment. When I think of Buechner, I think about the image that comes to my mind is, you know, down on Mill Bay Beach, there's this, you know, sort of creek that comes down the hillside through the boulders, and it comes onto the sand, and suddenly it goes underground. And that's him. You're sort of rushing along between the rocks, and suddenly you go deep. You're going to end up in the wide blue ocean, right? You're going to go in underneath first. He just goes deep. And And I want my writing to do that too. I want it to live and breathe out in the world, in the material world that we see and experience. But there's so much beyond what we see and experience. There's the whole realm of spirit and soul and love and all of that. And I want to access, I think, those really deep places that exist in all of us.
So what advice would you give to writers?
Well, that's a big question. Let me see, James, where are you right now as a writer? I think writers are always struggling. Or is there a particular area where you're thinking, what do I do about this? Or what about my next book?
Let's see here. I'm horrible with dialogue. how is that for a start?
a great thing for dialogue is, and this is so fun, this is something I would send my students out to do, is just, go to Safeway and go, let's see, where do people stand and ponder the most? Maybe in the produce aisle, and just go hang out and listen, eavesdrop on people, or go to Henry's. There's so many people and there's so many conversations. I love listening in. I'm not being a spy. I just love the way people speak and with the way they speak to each other in real conversation. And sometimes we try to make stuff up and, we're not them. We don't think or speak the way they do. So just listening to real conversation and writing it down, I think is a really great way. And this is what writers are. We are eavesdroppers on the world. This is what we get paid to do. So we're professionals, So don't feel guilty about it.
I won't feel guilty now,
right,
when I'm totally
exactly
listening in. I do that. Not the listening in part. I will start doing that. But I do look at people for extended periods of time. And I've actually been called out on it. Somebody's come up to me and they're like, why are you staring at me?
So that's great. I mean, you're already doing what writers have to do, is that just that curiosity about people and just to be people watchers. And that's one of the most fun things about being a writer, is we are charged with paying attention.
Mm-hmm. I know I do it at the airport as well. That's like
the
my
airport.
Favorite place
I
to go.
Know. And there's all the drama of coming and going, and occasionally you'll see a fight, or sometimes people are crying. Just, it's a place of such emotion, and so many stories are being created and are converging there. Yeah.
Talking about mentoring and advice that you would give other authors, could you explain a little bit about your Harvester Island Wilderness Workshop?
Yeah. I started that about 5 years ago now. So writers come from all over the country. I usually bring up another writer, so there are two of us, so that we have kind of two classes, two threads going. I always teach nonfiction. And the other person is usually either a poet or a fiction writer. I've had both. Actually, last year, I brought up two people. One was a very famous poet, and the other was a playwright and a memoirist and a fiction. I mean, she did everything. She did everything. So I did nonfiction. She did everything else. So that was really fun. I've brought up some very well-known people. I have more people coming this next year. I have Philip Yancey, who has, I think his number is like 14 million books have been sold worldwide. He's a brilliant nonfiction writer. And we're probably going to teach classes together. So what we do, there are between 15 and 20 people who come from all around the country and even outside the country. I had a woman come all the way from Australia.
Oh, wow.
And they come from Canada and various other places. And we gather together for a week on my fish camp island. And we spend the morning in classes and workshops. People usually have manuscripts that they're working on, and they're typically book manuscripts, although it might be an essay or something smaller, but normally it's a book-length manuscript. And we kind of work on it together. We jump into the hardest part. I try to address whatever they've identified as their central issue. And we do problem solving. I lead that, obviously, as the one there with the most experience. And I do a lot of teaching. We read other essays. And so we have classes and we do writing exercises. We workshop each other's stuff. And then the afternoon, we go out and go beachcombing and go whale watching and climb mountains and do all that fun stuff. And then for dinner, we gather every night for dinner. And then after dinner, we have readings, watch movies, and have panel discussions. And it's probably the best week of the whole year.
So you've mentioned lots of things that you enjoy about writing and your writing career. What is one thing that you could say you love about your writing career?
One thing I thought you were going to say, tell me one thing you hate about your writing career.
Yeah, you could do that too. That would definitely mix it up.
That would. Yeah, let me think for a second about what I hate, because I did say sort of a lot of things that I love. I tell you what I hate. because I'm facing this right now. There are a couple things. One is, you know, I've just finished Crossing the Waters, and it is a really exhausting process, just writing and pouring yourself out onto the page. And by the time you're done, you are so spent. You're so exhausted. And my agent, I have a wonderful agent, but he's been on me. He's been on my case for the last, you know, even 6 months before this book was done. Okay, Leslie, what's your next book? What's your next book? What's your next book? And I understand that's sort of the business of it, but I don't care. I'm not writing for the business of it. I am not ready to write another book. I have to be sort of seized with a compulsion almost outside of myself that I have to write about this. I have to write about food. I have to write about forgiveness. You know, every one of my books comes out of that deep sense of urgency and compulsion. And I don't have that right now. And I'm the kind of writer who can only write from that place. I mean, I don't want to write just to keep my career going. I don't want to write just to say I wrote. I want to write something that's going to go out into the world and make the world a better place. And the only way that happens is for me to write from the deepest places of need and curiosity, you know, that I myself have. So that's one thing I hate about writing, is sort of that business part of it. And the other part, it's related to that. It's the pressure. The whole publishing industry has changed with the digital revolution. And I've been publishing now for, I'm going to say 20 or 25 years. So, you know, when my books first came out, it was the old way, which was that the publisher was primarily responsible for arranging all your interviews and doing all the media and getting your book out there. And everything has changed. And even though, you know, I've had great publishers and I've had great publicists. My last book, HarperCollins was my publisher. I had 3 publicists assigned to me for my book. And now I have 1. But even so, most of the work of getting your book out there falls on you as the author, because social media has sort of taken over, and that's how books are sold. And I love social media and I hate social media. It's always that double-edged sword. So you end up having to be 3 people all the time. And this is another reason that I resigned from full-time teaching, is you have to be the marketer, you have to be the PR person, you have to be your own editor, and then you have to keep writing your next book. Mm-hmm. You know, plus you have to have a platform, you have to have not only an internet platform, but you have to have a public speaking platform. And I would anyway, because I love speaking. It's part of me and it's what I do. But there's an incredible amount of pressure on writers to be out there, to be doing everything all the time.
I completely understand 100%. You're right. Social media. I actually just got rid of Instagram. I got rid of Twitter. I got rid of my personal Facebook account.
Did you really?
It was sucking up every aspect of my writing time.
Yes.
Because I spent more time promoting.
Good for you.
And you find yourself checking it constantly.
I know.
You
know, like, I know.
And people don't realize, and I always have to explain to them, like, oh, your book's published. You know, now you just sit back.
Yeah, right. Like, now the work is done. Yeah, and
collect that big old check. And I always save my very first check as an example. And I always bring it. I think it's like $1.99.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Boom.
There it is.
Normally, you're boots on the ground. You're running around. You're calling people.
Yeah.
Even your publicist is just kind of sending you recommendations about what you need to follow up on.
And even, you know, James, even very well-known writers find themselves in the same position. I've lots and lots of writing friends, and some of them are big names, and they express, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
And the boat is leaky, you know? Right.
I'm going to cancel my social media.
I'm going to cancel you, is what they say next.
So what book are you reading now?
I actually have a huge stack next to my bed. Here's the funny thing that's happened. I am besieged with requests to endorse books.
Okay.
And people are so kind to read mine and endorse mine, and I want to return that favor. I don't endorse every book that comes to me by any means, but that becomes my reading. So right now, I have 5 books that I need to finish, and I have 2 endorsements that were due yesterday. So that's part of the writing life. The people have no idea that it's about being a good citizen in this writing community. And I love directing people to really great books. So I'm reading all these books before anyone else does. Kind of get a head start. Yeah.
So is there anything else you would like to share with our listening audience?
Yeah, James, I want to close just with a word of thanks to all my readers. And there are a lot of local people who have read maybe all of my books. A lot who have read maybe the last few books. And I'm so grateful to you. I am humbled and honored by you taking your time to buy my book and to read it and to write back. And you know what that feels like. That's such a great feeling because you're not done. You know, you send those words out into the world. In many ways, you don't feel like that act of communication is finished until something comes back to you. Because you're really not writing this for yourself. You really are writing this for other people to bring goodness and to bring wisdom and to bring grace and blessing into other people's lives. And when they write back and say, you know, I was really moved by this or touched by this or changed by this. And that is the deepest and the best compliment and gift that I could get back. And so many readers have done that locally. So I just thank you all. I love you all. Thank you. And keep reading, please.
Thank you very much, Leslie, for being on our show.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, James, and thank you so, so much, Leslie Leland Fields, for joining us on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales for the Beyond the Cover segment. We really appreciated that lovely chat. It's always nice to get to know one of our local heroes a little better. So up next on the show, I have Katie Baxter from the Kodiak Public Library back in with me to do a lively live chats segment. But before we do that, I wanted to touch base really briefly and remind everybody that coming up in February is our Altered Book Events. We're working with the Kodiak Arts Council once again this year to bring a fantastic Altered Book season to you. So please remember to start work on your Altered Book projects. Now is definitely the time. You don't want to be rushed in January. What's happening with Altered Books, if you're not familiar with it, is every year in February, the Kodiak Public Library and the Kodiak Arts Council get together and do an Altered Book event. This year, on February 3rd, that'll be the first Friday in February, at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium, there will be a display up in the foyer of all of the Altered Book projects that people have given to us for this year. So on February 3rd, please stop by the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. We will have live music and some nibbles and an opportunity for you to come and check out all of the Altered Book projects and vote on your crowd favorites. Those crowd favorites will win some fun prizes, so we want your input to see which one you liked the best. Then at the end of the month, on February 25th, we're having a Altered Books Gala. This will be a paid event held after hours at the Kodiak Public Library, where we have a chance to show off some of the best projects from the Altered Book season, as well as just have a celebration of everything Altered Book and wintry. There will be lots of live music, there will be lots of food, there will probably be a dessert auction, there will be various forms of spoken entertainment. It's going to be a bash. That again is happening February 25th on a Saturday at the Kodiak Public Library. More details on that to follow. If you're looking for details on what's going on with us at the Kodiak Public Library Association, I encourage you to check out our website, www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org, where we will very soon be putting up all of the event marketing for the Altered Book season, and you can always find out what's going on with us there. You can also become a member of the Kodiak Public Library Association if you want to support your local library. So again, that's www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. So for our December lively live chats, Katie Baxter from the Kodiak Public Library is here to chat with us. And it's a fun winter, it's looking like we've got going on. We've got snow, we've got ice. What has the library got for us?
I know. We have that icy drizzle. We have that crunch in the walkway, thanks to all the white snow. So my library staff and I, we just know it is time to plan seasonal stories for winter. So that is an annual event. Happens usually the third or fourth week in December. This year, it's December 22nd. From 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. So we've been pulling out the favorite books that usually end up in the read pile. And those books include things like The Hanukkah Guest by Eric Kimmel. We've got Uncle Walwa's Tree by Patricia Polacco. Before Morning by Joyce Simmons. Little Rabbit's Kwanzaa by Donna Washington. So you're picking up a theme here. Some of these are well-known classics. Others might be less familiar.
Sure.
And then we've got the ever-favorite On Christmas Eve by Peter Collington.
Wait, you've got On Christmas Eve in your seasonal books to read aloud list?
Exactly.
Really?
But wait, there's something funny about that.
Funny. It's charming. It's endearing. It's imaginative. What's funny about it?
Doesn't that book have no words?
No words. For our seasonal story time. Good point, Athenia. I believe there are a few words. There's words in the dedication, and I believe the dedication reads, "Dedicated to chimneyless children everywhere."
So the chimneyless children get the wordless story.
Yes, I know. Seems like it's a book about a lot of lack. But no, it turns out to be a wonderful wordless picture book that invites different personal narration. And so I wanted to talk with you and our audience today about the value of wordless picture books.
I've never actually heard of wordless picture books before.
Oh.
No.
Well, and I happened to bring one with me that was on display in November during our family literacy month, because when I saw Caitlin put this out on display, I remembered this book really caught my attention, and I was an adult when I first saw it. It's called Yellow Umbrella, and it's about rainy weather. So it's kind of nice that we're talking about weather today. We go from the rain to the snow. You can take a look at it. What are you noticing about?
Oh, this book is cute. It looks arty. It's almost abstract paintings with umbrellas, mm-hmm. of which there is one yellow one in every picture. Mm-hmm. They're really beautiful. They're almost like watercolor paintings.
And does anything in a rainy day remind you of a watercolor?
Oh, that's very true, Katie. I like this. Like the umbrellas, each page actually does have something going on, and you could make up what it is. So on the page I'm looking at, there is a train passing, and all of the umbrellas are stopped at the barricade before the train crossing, or the little orange umbrella that's left behind. So these books contain interesting pictures that allow you to make up your own story?
Exactly. Oh. Yeah, I really like, yes, you're capturing the magic of a wordless picture book. Very often when we have illustrated picture books, we are so focused on the words, and particularly people new to reading, they might get stuck on reading the exact word in the correct way, not quite understanding the word. But as you go through this book, you're starting to tell me a story. I wasn't even looking at the page you were on, but you mentioned the train and the umbrellas that stopped at the barricade, and I got a picture in my mind. So you're using the language that you know to describe a concept, a thought, an image, and we're exchanging a creative experience.
So we make our own story.
You make your own story. And these books promote more discussion than books with words, which can lead to better comprehension for people learning vocabulary. And if you notice, Athenia, I'm not saying for children.
Right.
Learning vocabulary. I mean people.
Right.
This runs the gamut of reading comprehension, reading development, using a picture book with adults new to Kodiak, new to the state, new to the country, can really help people share common experience.
Right. So using a book to spark a discussion, a literary discussion about it.
Mm-hmm. And when I listened to you use the word barricade, I thought, if I didn't know what that meant, over our discussion about the picture, I would feel very comfortable saying to you, Athenia, what's barricade?
Right.
And I'm not sure we do that when we're listening to a parent or a grandparent or a friend read aloud from a narrative text.
Right. You wouldn't want to stop the flow of the narration by asking if you don't know a word.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're just having a chat with a friend about a book, then you have the opportunity to ask. That's a good point.
Yeah. And what we find when we use the wordless picture books in library story times, and when teachers are using wordless books in the classroom, is we're helping our listeners, as well as ourselves, I feel, develop our storytelling skills. And we also are able to make that movement over time from telling a story
to writing a story.
Because it can be pretty overwhelming sitting down to write a story. Mm-hmm. But everybody tells stories. It's how we pass knowledge on. It's how we remember things. And it would be good practice for people wanting to participate in galley tables to sit down with a wordless picture book and develop their storytelling abilities.
Perfect. Perfect connection to the Kodiak community. I love it. So Ellie was sharing with me why she likes to use the wordless picture books in her story times with our different ages of kids, mm-hmm. getting back to kids.
Yeah.
And so for children who are pre-readers, they feel very comfortable sitting down with the wordless book because they're not sitting there realizing, I can't read this word. So wordless books are excellent to use with struggling readers or children with visual impairment or children perhaps with Down syndrome. They can actually share in a storytelling experience. You can pass the book around and have each person in your reading circle share what's going on with the page through their natural oral storytelling, their own knowledge of vocabulary.
That's great. So even if you're not comfortable, if you get overwhelmed looking at words, like you said earlier, you're too focused on the words, you don't have time to enjoy the picture, this book is for all of those people to just enjoy the picture.
Exactly, because we can all look for clues in a story.
Yes.
It's really exciting. And then those children who become beginner readers, when they're encouraged by their recognition of a certain amount of vocabulary, they begin to realize that they can read a story fluently, but they can also still have the freedom of using their own words at their own choosing. That can just be very, again, very motivating, very unintimidating. I'm getting through a book. I can do this.
Yeah.
And again, that picking out of visual clues is very important in our cognitive development. I can remember a time when I was reading aloud a story. It did have narrative text, but there were beautiful full pages of just illustration. And one of my young readers was following the story, the progression. It was about a bear coming out of hibernation. And she was able to spot the clue in the nature scene that bear soon would be leaving the cave, the place of hibernation. And she was able to share that in a very almost lyrical or musical way during the storytelling. She wasn't interrupting me. She was joining me. And she was motivated by this wordless page of the book. It was really fun. And the kids just all looked at her and they moved closer to the book. It was really the fun power of a wordless picture.
Yeah, it's true. So often you read a book that has pictures and they're kind of a second thought. It's mm-hmm. something you'll maybe read the words and then look at the picture before you move on, rather than really appreciating the picture for what it can tell you.
Yes. Yeah, I love how you put that. And then we move on to our independent readers. Again, they're reading alone. They can add their own detail about the setting, about the characters, about the plot. And so again, just what I'm listing there, setting, characters, plot, action, result, theme. They're learning storytelling skills.
Right, right. Those are important storytelling skills, those are important writing skills. You'll even need to use some of those skills writing essays in university or college or wherever life takes you after that.
Yes, yes, exactly. And again, wordless picture books have really earned an important place within our schools, within the classroom environment, within literacy activities at the public libraries. And this summer, I was looking at an article published in Children and Libraries by a librarian out of New York. And she was noting that the wordless picture books in the publishing world are on the rise. And within libraries, and I would say at Kodiak Public Library, we continue to invest in that part of our collection. If people in our listening audience were curious about what we have, they could certainly go to the Kodiak Public Library online site, click on our catalog, and you could do a keyword search, Stories Without Words. And you'd get pages and pages. We've got about 62 titles that pop up And most of those books are in our easy picture book collection.
But that was my next question.
Yes, go ahead. Did I answer
you
it?
You did. So that's where you find them. So a lot of them are in the easy picture book collection. But if you want more, you have to go on to that keyword search.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good. And 62 books, that's actually quite a few. So there is a real demand for these books.
Yes. You know, across the nation, we've been paying more and more attention to how we learn to read. Because as human beings, we were not initially created to read.
Right.
We are a people of oral storytelling. So over our development, our brain evolved into a reading machine, if you will. And to encourage that reading fluency and being attuned to listening for vocabulary, wordless books have been very important in the teaching of reading or exposing emerging readers to reading experiences. And so publishers have really looked to create more and more of a market for the wordless books, which is fine. I mean, it's a quality market. And I believe the book that we started out with during today's chat,
The Yellow Umbrella,
yes, by Jay Su Lu. And I will say that this does come with a music CD.
Oh, nice.
But I know that when this book was first released and promoted by the publisher during conference, and it would have been back in around 2002, this made a splash, Yellow Umbrella, because of the beautiful art illustrations that you were mentioning earlier, that it's an artsy book. It's visually rich. If you think of another book that would have come out earlier than this, The Snowman, which I believe that came out around the mid-90s, that grabbed everyone's attention during this time of year as a winter book, just because of that simple connection we all have with snowmen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly here in Kodiak, to get enough snow to actually create that snowman. What a celebration, what a joy.
Yes.
And so there was that connection between children and adults and the grandparents and siblings and teachers. And that book just sold so many copies during the winter holiday season. And it was a wordless book, very, very simple.
Right.
And eventually it inspired a film.
Right. And I'm noticing now this Yellow Umbrella was what, New York Times best illustrated book?
Yes.
So they're getting recognition.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. From all members of the creative community, the artists, the musicians, the writers. It's an exciting genre.
Yeah. So if you're an artist and maybe you don't think you're a reader, this is a way for you to be both.
Exactly. Yes. So I can see your enthusiasm.
Yes.
And I'm imagining you're going to go to that catalog, online catalog, any day now. Look up Stories Without Words.
Stories Without Words.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also wordless books can be used. But I noticed Stories Without Words brought up more books from our collection.
Okay.
And just borrow away.
Well, I
and
will.
Enjoy.
And of course, I'll be getting out there for that seasonal Stories of Winter that's happening on December 22nd. I won't forget about that either. Thank you very much, Katie,
yes,
for coming in and sharing with us these wordless storybooks that I had never heard of before. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Athenia.
All right, we only have a few minutes left on the show today, so I would like to end things with a community roar, which is a rave over amazing reads, where we share with you some of our favorite reads. Before I go, I'd just like to say one last thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in tonight, and we'll see you again next month. I'm Athenia, and on behalf of the Kodiak Public Library Association, I'd like to wish you another month of happy reading.
Hi, this is Leanne Schmelzenbach, and as I'm visiting, I'm doing some things here with Athenia to help her. She asked me to do some book review. And I'm excited to talk about this one today. It's called Angelology. It's by Daniel Trussoni, and it was published in 2010. Now, I hate the title. First of all, it's very difficult to say, Angelology. It doesn't really roll off the tongue very well. However, that does not color how much I enjoy this book. I started reading this book because I was intrigued. I have a thing about vampires. Not that I want to be one, because I don't. Nor do I think that the popular image of the vampire is something that I ever really want to promote or indulge. However, I'm fascinated with the fact that people might want to live forever because I don't want to. And there was a little blurb on the back of this book that talked about, it says, vampires move over, dark angels are the new thing. And I just started laughing. I thought, what? What is this book? So I picked it up. And when I opened the cover, I was amazed. The writing is so easy to read. And it ties in all this different history of World War II. And it brings in Greek mythology. And her descriptions are poignant. And yet, they're almost like Leonardo da Vinci's sketches. She sketches out the images that she wants you to see just enough for you to get an idea of where things are going and what people look like. But she lets your imagination color the lines and really solidify what you think the characters look like and what you think the settings might be and what you think is happening in the action. And that's something that I don't run into very often. So I really am enjoying Angelology because it is currently what I am reading. So there's one main character, and this also I found really funny because this topic has come up in my life a lot lately. And no, I'm not going to become a nun. But the main character is a nun. She's 23 years old. She's a nun in a convent in New York called St. Rose's Convent, and it was established by Mother Francesca. I don't know if this convent actually exists. I don't think it does. but that's neither here nor there. The main character is this young nun. She is in this convent where they honor and study the angels as the messengers of God, but they were established in order to pray for the adoration of Christ. And the prayer has gone unbroken for 250 years since the establishment of this convent. And she, at 23, which blows my mind, has taken her vows to be a nun. And if you know anything about what those vows include or the process involved of becoming a nun, that might blow your mind like it did mine. So she discovers this request from an art historian to find out whether or not he can have access to their library, because their library has a vast collection of angel archives, pictures, studies done on the of the writings on angels, the documentation of very famous philosophers of angels, et cetera, et cetera. And when she gets this letter, it's the crack in the windshield. It has the spider effect because it's the first chip, and the little spiders of doubt and the little introductions to other characters begins. And then as you continue to read, and she discovers more about her past and about the people in the convent, other nuns in the convent. And then she meets this young art historian. And I don't know if they fall in love or not, because I'm not at the end of the book. So you get to discover just like I do if you pick up Angelology. But it has that spiderweb effect. So it starts with this chip in the windshield that starts to like make her wonder if this really is what her life has always been. And then it spiders out, and fairly soon her idea of how the world works and what her past really was and who her parents was and how she fits into this whole spiritual and also physical battle between the Nephilim and human beings shatters the glass house. And she is introduced to this vibrant, amazing, violent, and powerful reality. For those of you who are not familiar with the term Nephilim, the Nephilim are the mythological byproduct of angels who had sex with human women and they had children, and those are the Nephilim. And so this war is happening, and when her glass house shatters, she walks into the war, and it's just incredible. I think that this book is a really good read because it's easy to track the characters, it's easy to track the plot line, but if you're interested or have any knowledge of like World War II or Greek mythology, or you know anything about the convent, monastic life, or if you like art, or, you know, it just takes all these little things and it turns it into this phenomenal novel that's just super fun to read, and it weaves the tales of the different characters together so beautifully. The point that I am at the book, and it's a point that I hope all of you make it to as well if you choose to read Angelology, is where all of those characters' lives are starting to come together to form the cohesive plot line, and I'm super excited to finish this book. So if you like angels and you like fiction and you like fiction that has some history in it and it pulls in ancient as well as modern literary mythology, then Angelology by Daniel Trussoni, published in 2010, is your read.
simplest of pleasures, the world at its best.